Welcome to The Sediment. We are here recording an episode after the Pediatric Academic Society's meeting in Toronto, which was a great success. And today I have a lot of pediatric nephrologists who were at the meeting and helped to moderate some great sessions. So thanks everyone for coming. My name's Emily Zangla, and I'm a third-year pediatric nephrology fellow at the University of Minnesota. And this year, I'm the associate podcast editor along with Suda Garamella, who is in charge, and she is still the reigning podcast editor here. So, Suda, thanks for being here and showing me the ropes.
Oh my goodness, Emily, thank you so much. I am super excited to get the chance to co-host this excellent podcast with you. This is the Sediment's fourth year running. And prior to that, we did have an ASPN podcast that was done by Ibrahim Shattat, which, led to the Sediment, and we're just standing on the shoulders of giants here. But I am really, really excited about tonight's podcast because we have a great set of, thought leaders in the field, and I'm hoping we'll have an exciting discussion about some of the sessions that went on at ASPN annual meeting in Toronto, Canada this year.
Yeah, so I'll have everyone introduce themselves and remember, give us a fun fact. We're all about the fun facts. So, Neha, do you want to go first?
Yeah, sure. Hi, everyone. My name is Neha Padanat. I'm a peds nephrologist, faculty at Indiana University in Indianapolis, Indiana, and Riley Children's Hospital. Fun fact about me is I have a background in music and dance. I grew up, I did like, I think, 12 years of piano lessons and a ton of dance classes. And so that's still my hobby.
What kind of dance? That's really cool.
I was a ballet, tap, jazz, everything, Indian dance, just anything that I could do. Yeah.
Wow. That's great.
Well, that's amazing, Neha. And I know that takes a lot out of people. Having been I'm now a dance mom, so I understand exactly how hard that whole discipline is to achieve that in addition to, a full-time career. So kudos to you.
Thank
Yeah. Megan.
Hi, I'm Megan Yannick. I'm a pediatric nephrologist at Atrium Health Levine Children's Hospital in Charlotte, and an assistant professor through the Wake Forest University. A fun fact about me is that I love being outside and camping with my family. So for many of our time away, we will be out in the camper, exploring nature, hiking, going to the beach.
You have your own camper?
We do, yep.
Oh, cool.
Wow,
That's really cool.
and you're in the
Actually,
right
we're
part of the
gonna.
country for camping, right? You're in the right part of the country.
Yes, we've got great places to go around Charlotte, into the mountains, up down to the beach. But hopefully, when my kids get a little older, we'll make the long drive out west and do some of the national parks out there.
Yeah, that's cool. Great. Well, thanks for being here. Chuck.
Hi, I'm Chuck Parnell. Thanks for excuse me. Well, thanks for letting me join this evening. I am one of the nephrologists at Cincinnati Children's Hospital. I've been there since I was an intern, which is maybe kind of a fun fact. But I think if I had to say my fun fact would be I like to play. Well, I used to play a lot of video games as a kid. I play less now due to work, but I do play with my kids, and I always tell the patients when we're doing kidney biopsies, I feel like my video game history has made me pretty good at ultrasound kidney biopsies. So I encourage them, despite what your parents say, keep playing video games. One day it may come in handy. So,
What's your favorite game, Chuck? Which
we do a lot of
one?
Mario Kart on the Switch in my house, so that's where we're at right now.
That could be a
Wonderful.
good tactic to get more pediatric nephrologists,
There you go.
tell them it's like playing a video game.
Just like it.
Amy?
Hi, my name's Amy Strong. I am also a pediatric nephrologist at the University of Iowa Stead Family Children's Hospital. And I really hate the question that asks a fun fact about myself. I don't blame you for asking it, but I can never feel like I can never come up with anything interesting about myself. I also used to be a dancer. I also used to play video games, and I also like to camp. That last one might be a little bit of a lie. But the one that is coming to mind right now, my fun fact that's very, you know, timely is, does everyone know who Caitlin Clark is? Like, she's not just an Iowan sensation, right? She's like a American sensation. Sorry, Rulon. So I grew up next door to her, Des Moines, Iowa, which is kind of cool. It kind of makes me feel famous. I'm very unathletic. So, you know, I didn't inherit the skills, but that's kind of a fun fact, I think.
Yeah,
hey,
that's
you're
really
you're
cool.
Perfectly entitled to bask in reflected glory. I mean, she's amazing.
Yeah,
why not, right?
Yeah, we're really proud. You know, as an Iowan, we're really proud of her. So,
yeah, that's cool. Rulon, thanks for coming.
Thanks. My name is Rulon Parikh. I'm the Vice President for Academics, which includes research, innovation, education at Women's College Hospital. I'm an adult and pediatric nephrologist, and I still practice at the Hospital for Sick Children here in Toronto. A fun fact, you know, similar to Amy, I'm always like, oh, what, I just work all the time. But I think a fun fact is that I'm actually both Canadian and American, and I got to vote in my first election for Barack Obama.
Yay!
Wow, that's great.
I had just moved back to Canada. And I just moved back to Canada, but I flew down so I could make sure that I voted for him.
Wow.
That's amazing.
Yeah, that's great.
That was also my first election that I voted in as a US citizen.
So
cool. Wonderful. Well, welcome to the podcast, everyone. We have a busy agenda, and what we're going to do is we're going to try to recap three excellent sessions that happened at ASPN in Toronto recently.
So we're going to start off with a special population transplant session from PAS. So Megan and Chuck, you were the moderators there. And some of those sessions were dealing with a highly sensitized patient, complement disorders, dual immune and solid organ transplants, and childhood cancer patients. So Megan or Chuck, do you want to start us off and just maybe share with listeners you know, how everything was received and maybe some of the high yield points from the sessions?
I guess I can go ahead and start by saying I think this was a great session. It played right into my ADD, and that it was a nice potpourri of different transplant topics, some of which I personally had some experience with, but then others not so much. So, you know, I think Dr. Shao with her transplant of childhood cancer talk was really enlightening for me. I think one of the debates that actually came up afterwards, there was some conversation around what to do with patients who have rising EBV viremia in the setting of immunosuppression. You know, one of the facts that stuck with me was somewhere, I think any of us who take care of transplant patients know, up to 60% of them are going to have some detectable EBV viremia. Some very small subset of them end up going on to develop PTLD that's EBV driven down the line. And so which of these patients do you change immunosuppression on? And I was having some conversations during the posters with different people who had very strong feelings about what you should do, but none of their thoughts and feelings tended to be persistent across the board. So that definitely has stuck with me. So Megan, I'll let you add some.
Yeah, so for the talk on survivors of childhood cancer, some of she kind of broke the talk, as Chuck said, into two parts. You know, first talking about cancer survivors, and then kind of shifting to talking more about you know, cancer onset post transplant with PTLD. For the first part of her talk, some of the interesting points that I felt like she brought up was that there was a late cumulative incidence of kidney failure in childhood cancer survivors of about 1% by age 40 versus 0.2% in healthy siblings. So I thought that was interesting. And she mentioned that stjude.org has a kidney failure calculator available to estimate the risk of chronic kidney disease and kidney failure in childhood cancer survivor patients. She talked about how hypertension was a common reason that survivorship refers to nephrology clinics. and mentioned that some of the highest risk patients were ones that had actually received ifosfamide, you know, total body radiation, and then of course patients that have nephrectomies. So those are some of the learning points I got from her talk.
Yeah, that's great. I didn't know there was a calculator. That could definitely come in handy.
I've never heard of that before either. So it'll be, you know, something that'll be interesting to look at with some of my clinical patients.
Yeah, definitely. And was that's aside from bone marrow transplant patients, right? This, we're talking more of the solid organ.
I haven't played with the calculator yet, but my understanding was that it was for any patient for any childhood cancer survivor. So okay. I'll have to get on there and actually play with the tool, but I thought it was a good reference for us to use.
Yeah, definitely. All right. And then I think the next one was the highly sensitized patient, which I know is really difficult for a lot of us when that PRA is really high and they're sitting on the transplant list for a while. So Chuck, do you want to start us off with that one?
Sure. So Dr. Pulianda gives a very compelling and really easy to follow lecture format. So if you've heard her speak before, you know what I'm talking about. And if you haven't, you should definitely either invite her to come talk to your group or try and watch a lesson. You know, I've read some of the work they've published before, but what was most compelling to me is they seem to be very aggressive with their treatment of antibodies. So and I don't say that with like a judgment, like too aggressive. It's just their threshold to start desensitization, I believe she said, was somewhere around a PRA of 30 prior to transplant, and seemed to have some thoughts and suggestions with the data that may help long-term graft survival even prior to transplant. So not necessarily desensitizing for a particular recipient, but just you have a certain PRA, start desensitization early prior to transplant. So I was not familiar with that paradigm myself because that's not how we practice, but definitely something I need to read more about.
Yeah. Great. And she has pretty good outcomes, I think, in terms of her patients. And I know she had a picture of her back in India, and she kind of gave them the protocol, right?
She did a great job of, you know, reminding us that these aren't just numbers and antibodies, like bringing it back to actual patients that are now transplanted because of this work. So,
yeah. Oh, excellent.
Yeah, and I saw the relative intensity score, and, you know, obviously I'm not a transplant nephrologist, but that was new to me too. Is that something that all centers calculate routinely?
I at least see them on our PRA reports. So I know it's one of the reported measures that comes out on that. I'm not sure how universal that is though.
Okay. She made a strong case for using that more rigorously.
Yeah,
so sure. I thought that was interesting too, to somebody, you know, taking care of these patients and, you know, watching them sit for years on lists. Anything that advances the science, I think, changes lives and helps improve their quality of life. So it's that was a very good overall overview of the highly sensitized patient.
Yeah. Megan, do you want to talk a little bit about the complement disorders? The speaker did a really good job because that's a hard topic.
Sure. Yeah. Dr. Christopher Litch from Hospital for Sick Kids in Toronto presented on complement dysregulation in transplant patients, and focused his talk on the majority of it was on atypical HUS, but then also spoke at the end on C3 glomerulonephritis. He went through a lot of different studies that have tried to risk stratify patients with atypical HUS and which ones should stay on prophylactic eculizumab indefinitely versus which patients may be lower risk and may be okay to be off eculizumab post-transplant. And so there were several studies, and you know, he was pointing out the higher risk patients were ones that had, you know, an identified, you know, pathogenic mutation in the complement, one of the complement proteins, persistent factor H autoantibodies. And then some of the lower risk patients were considered ones that had isolated MCP mutations, or patients that were successfully treated and were persistently negative for factor H autoantibodies. So I found, all of those talks interesting. He also mentioned a CURE IHUS study that was trying to explore, an alternate approach and trying to avoid using eculizumab due to its high cost. I found that it was a very small study, but particularly interesting. There were 17 patients, and they used an approach where everyone had a living donor, where they used lower dose calcineurin inhibitor and really aggressive blood pressure management. And even though 15 of 17 of those patients met high risk criteria, only one had a TMA recurrence. So found that interesting as well, and would like to go back and look at that, some of the details of that study a little bit further. And then regarding C3 glomerulonephritis, he mentioned some of the up and coming, direct C3 inhibitors, which I think are, really promising and, give us kind of new hope for these patients. And especially, myself, I've had recent patients, I'm sure you have as well, where you have C3 glomerulonephritis recurrence, and it's such a frustrating situation, even if they're on eculizumab and they recur despite that. You mentioned these newer drugs, I may butcher their pronunciation, but the iptacopan and the pegcetacopan, both that have studies that are finishing up. And I think, just look for more data coming out on those in the future.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you. They're all similar, but different too, with all those disorders and stratifying patients, especially after transplant. So it's good that we have some new things coming down the pipeline. Chuck, anything to add, or do you want to kick us off on the dual transplant?
We can move on. Megan did a great job. I always think compliment talks are always a big alphabet soup to get through.
Yep. So
did great with that. Yeah, Dr. Grimm at Stanford talked about dual immune solid organ transplant for kidney failure, and they're doing some really fascinating stuff out there. So they first published in the New England Journal their report of Schimke's immune osseous dysplasia, I believe is the name of that disease, or Schimke's disease, where they would do bone marrow transplant and kidney transplant kind of combined or within particular sequence. And then from that experience with their BMT group there, they've started to think about what other conditions would it make sense to do both a BMT and a kidney transplant. And I believe they at least have a protocol or are considering patients who potentially have sickle cell disease, types of FSGS, like primary FSGS, as potentially patients that this could benefit. As you might expect with a bone marrow transplant, not every case has had great outcomes. So I know he did report they had at least one death as a result of the transplants. And so they're currently kind of in a pullback mode, just reevaluating the protocols, making sure that was everything done, as safe as it could have been. Are there areas for improvement, opportunities to adjust the protocol? But really promising, particularly for those of us who think about, the long-term problems related to chronic immunosuppression, whether it's the cancer risk, the adherence risk, the rejection risk, if you can find anything to alleviate that, that brings a lot of hope for me, even though we're still kind of in this very early stage.
And what year did he start this? Like, how long do we have data now?
I don't recall off the top of my head, Megan, if you happen to know when that started. I know that New England paper was just in the last couple of years that they reported Schimke's. So that's relatively recent.
I'm not exactly sure on the year. I think it's been within the last couple of years, but he reported specifically on 6 patients that they had done.
Okay.
With some mixed results. And one of the other interesting observations he pointed out was that the patients with the Schimke in general did better. They did not have issues with graft versus host disease versus the patient with FSGS, and they did a patient with cystinosis, and they encountered a lot more complications with graft versus host disease. He was speculating about what the difference, between those patients might be, and that, the Schimke's patients already have immune system dysfunction versus a normal immune system and these other disease processes. So obviously, not a worked out process yet, but I think does give us a lot of hope from the future if we can build on their knowledge and gives, transplant patients of the future hope that they may not be dependent on lifelong immunosuppression.
Yeah, definitely. Neha, you have a story about a Shimke patient?
Yeah, cool. I actually unfortunately missed Dr. Grimm's talk, but he's been so helpful because within the last year, we had referred a patient from Indiana to California who had Shimke and got a bone marrow and kidney transplant. And it was absolutely amazing, guys. It's like to go through that experience with this patient. So I'm excited to hear your guys' take on it. He was a teenager who was diagnosed with FSGS and had rapidly progressing to end stage kidney disease on to dialysis. And then, when we started using the Renasight genetic testing more regularly is when we, how we diagnosed him with Shimke. He had a couple of bad infections that mm-hmm. fall too. I remember initially it was COVID and I was like, well, everybody's getting COVID. So, but then he had some other ones too, and just kind of a more lengthy time recovering from them. And that's the immunodeficiency part that made us wonder what's going on here. And so after making the diagnosis and after, I think, reading that New England Journal article is how we had reached out. He got his bone marrow transplant and then had some issues with, like you mentioned, graft versus host. He did have some issues with that. Our patient did. But yeah, ultimately got the kidney transplant and now has moved back to Indiana and doing pretty well. So it's so exciting to think about possibilities for the future.
Yeah, that's so cool.
Is he on any immunosuppression at all at the moment?
Yes, he is, low levels. I think that it was a bit having to do with the graft versus host, I think, problems he had post or pre-kidney transplant. I just don't know that the length of, it's not near the amount of immunosuppression as just kidney alone. And I think there's some plans to reduce it. So yeah, exciting.
Yeah, I got the impression with these patients that it's more related to the bone marrow transplant piece of it, just keeping mm-hmm. that under control more so than the kidney related.
Kidney itself, right.
Wow, that's so cool that you've seen it
yeah.
in your own patients. So terrific. All right. Well, anything else that we should talk about for this session?
I was just going to say, I looked up the calculator because I was so fascinated.
Yeah.
Great for Google, but they have lots of calculators and it's actually quite interesting. So I put in like a mock patient, but it was interesting to me that they have that much information. And they also ask about multiple drug exposure. So yeah, really interesting calculator use. It does seem like, as Megan talked about, that hypertension seems to be the biggest predictor.
Oh, wow. And this is from what website?
This is from the St. Jude's website.
Okay.
Yeah.
Terrific.
We'll have a link to that in the show notes for this episode so people can take a look at it.
I think the only thing I'd add too is just as someone who mostly takes care of transplant patients, I appreciated the PAS opportunity to really highlight and kind of go deep on a couple of things. So I think hopefully they'll continue to encourage, transplant related topics in the future for future sessions.
Absolutely. And you know that for general nephrologists who don't do transplants at their center, probably will not attend ATS or any of the transplant only conferences. So that's our only exposure and window to improve our knowledge if it is presented at PAS. So we certainly support that. These diseases are rare and the number of populations that, that we take care of are small, and it is, hard to be data-driven and evidence-based if we don't have RCTs and, the usual way in which we evaluate the efficacy of, treatments. And so this is a great segue to our mm-hmm. next topic that we had that, Rulan, you were the moderator for this excellent session. So I would like to ask you to just give us an overview, what was the, the intent behind providing this content? Did it achieve what this whole session was set out to do? And what were some of the highlights? We would love to know.
Yeah, it was a great session, and I moderated it with Amy, and the title was "Use Big Ideas and Big Data to Study Small Numbers of Small Patients." So I actually thought the title was appropriate, and I think one of the things that has happened in pediatrics and pediatric nephrology is we do have these rare diseases. So Schimke's was an example, like these really rare or ultra rare conditions. And even our nephrotics, who we take care of a lot, are not that rare, but it's relatively rare compared to other diseases. And so the question is, how can we manage our patients and generate the evidence that you just talked about needing to in order to support care? And there were three speakers. One was talking about clinical trials in nephrology, Deb Gibson, who's at the NIH, Rahul Chanchlani talking about using big data in clinical research. He's at McMaster University here in Hamilton, Canada, and he talked about his type of research. And then we had Joyce Samuels talking about innovative trial designs and big ideas for small numbers. And so that was really interesting. I think all three speakers were quite phenomenal, very different areas. So what I might do maybe is, maybe Amy, I'll just talk about, maybe I'll talk about Joyce's first, if that's okay. She talked about innovative trial design, and it was fascinating because it really highlighted how we could do trials in children and almost give personalized medicine. And so she actually talked about doing not crossover trials, but actually doing N of ones, and you do a series of repeated N of ones. So you do an N of one trial for 8 weeks with one antihypertensive, then move to a second antihypertensive for another 8 weeks, and then a third antihypertensive. And what's great is that you randomize the order depending on the patient, but then you're able to tell the patient at the end of those, let's say 3 8-week periods, this was the drug that you actually lowered your blood pressure the most on, and this is the drug we're going to put you on. And so what was fascinating was I've never thought about N of one trials like this. And I thought, wow, this is a way that we could get to personalized medicine in nephrology. It's, you know, it's limited. You can only do it for short-term outcomes like hypertension, but how fascinating that we could really start thinking about how to approach it in a very different way. And so I started thinking about all the other types of diseases that we could study. So really, it was a great idea. And she's shown it in essential hypertension. But I think it's probably true in like hypertension related to chronic kidney disease or hypertension on dialysis or, you know, hypertension post-transplant. Like, I actually think that there are lots of areas that we could apply this to. And that would be a great way, I think, for us to address a condition in a rare population where we feel overwhelmed with it, but we don't have enough evidence to justify managing them a certain way, that we could come up with a way to manage them in a unique way. And I think patients might like that because, you know, they always tell us how unique they all are. And then we use evidence-based medicine using a population average. And then we say to them, well, everybody responds, you know, on average like this. And they say, well, I didn't respond like that. And you're like, well, let's try on another medication. And so rather than adding on medications, we could actually try this approach and then do one at a time and see the best blood pressure control and then only use a single agent, which I think would be a great way to think about it. So I was very excited. So it was Joyce Samuels, and sort of from Texas. And I think we should all kind of look at her work and see what she's doing. I think it was really creative and very innovative. So I'll stop there.
Yeah, thank you. It is really cool that you can, you know, not only help your patients, but then help the knowledge that we need to move the field forward. So
that's excellent. I just was going to add that I agree. I just thought that session was so great. And I had read her paper beforehand, and it was like a light bulb, like what a simple, you know, beautiful way to do a study. And she was so thoughtful. I had asked her, you know, how did you make sure that there wasn't contamination between a patient? Like, they have a pill bottle, which, how do they know which one to be taken? And they actually would see them in clinic, and they would take the medicine away that they weren't supposed to be on. And it was just very well thought out, both in the trial design and, you know, the idea. And I agree with the thought that study type can just really be used in so many different, you know, areas that we practice. And so I thought that was a really exciting one. the whole, you know, I thought the whole session was sort of just a testament to us taking the problems we face and doing research in pediatric nephrology and kind of flipping it on its head. So we were, you know, we're always complaining about how we have small numbers of patients and how we can never do things like the adults do. And I just felt like it was such an inspiring session in that, that we really can. We can do these things and we can do them well. And maybe we don't always have to just extrapolate from adult data. And so, you know, the next, you know, the speaker, Dr. Shinklani, talked about big data and how that's, you know, going to just really help us move forward. It sort of helps us think about, you know, as the way the world is moving, how does medicine move along with it? And, you know, we're getting access to these just huge sources of data in our daily life. And I think it's exciting to think about where we're going to be in 10 years. I think all of us have done research as parts of our career, and the data getting is always the biggest part, the biggest headache. And so, you know, when he talked about sort of the way that the data sources are moving, I think we all felt inspired that we're going to be able to do better in the next few years.
And is that with using like the EMRs and just kind of sharing the data that way? Is that where the big data comes from?
There was a lot of different ways that, you know, we talked about that. Just, you know, if one of the ones that sticks out to me is talking about wearable device data and how that is something that we can use in our futures to do research too. And so, you know, lots of different ways and that I think will kind of help move us forward as we think outside the box a little bit.
Yeah, excellent.
Yeah, I think it's thinking about, you have electronic medical record data, but there's also population level data that gets collected. And then there's also things like NASA and geospatial data that's available. And there's like data on, you know, all sorts of environmental exposures. And, you know, so I think it's like, how do you combine all of these different types of data to ask important questions? And I think what I also like to agree with Amy is that it's like, how do we generate evidence? And, you know, sometimes a single story that you see in a patient in clinic, you know, there's that poem, you know, the world in a grain of sand. But then how do you prove that it wasn't just random and that, in fact, it is really something that's important? And then how do you generate that evidence? Well, now there are all these data sets that you can go to, both in the States and Canada and Europe, that are available. And how can you collaborate with people, do that kind of work, ask important questions, and then think about how to use that data to address some of our key questions we have in nephrology. So there are limitations, obviously, but I think that the data continue to get bigger and hopefully more detailed over time.
Right. That's and right. The methodologies continue to evolve, because one thing is data being available and the other thing is making sense of it, instead of it being like you're drinking from a huge source and not being able to parse what is actually relevant or how much bias creeps into those methods. So I think he gave an excellent overview of where we are with pediatrics, and with an excellent talk.
Yeah, and then the last one was Deb Gibson, who talked from the NIH. And really, I think her call to nephrologists was like, this is the time to get organized, right? Like, we can do this. And it was clear with Joyce's N of one, but we could also get platform trials or basket trials, or learn how to set things up now in order to set up trials. For example, SGLT2 inhibitor trial is going to come down the pike in the next few months. And the question is, how can we all get ready for that in order to all collaborate? Because we all of us want to see if it really works or not, because we think, will it be the statin of the 21st century for children, right? And so we need to understand that. And so I think thinking about how we do that, I think that's really important. So I think also moving away from doing single center work, but really doing multi-center trials as much as possible, but also how we can set them up so that they're built in Epic already, that we're using data that's already there within electronic medical record of whatever sort, and then get ready for those kind of things. So I think I felt between, you know, Joyce Samuels and Deb Gibson's talk, it was really like, okay, We need to get a little bit more structured, a little bit more organized, and think about like what should the next, how should we work together for the next 5 years?
I love that you said it was a call to action, because that was exactly how I felt after the session. And it was so beautifully timed, because it was, you know, towards the end of the conference, and we had been hearing the science of our respective areas. And then it's like, let's take it all together and think about how to do the science. It was cool. There was actually multiple people in the audience too, that were not pediatric nephrologists, that were, you know, pediatric other subspecialists. And so I think it was widely applicable to all involved, and just a really fun session to be a part of.
Yes, absolutely. I think that that's the beauty of PAS, is when ASPN holds its meeting at the same time as PAS, we get the opportunity to not only listen to our, you know, allied fields and other thought leaders, but we get to interact with people who are not nephrologists who come in and listen to our talks and our sessions and provide valuable input. So that's one of the best parts about PAS and the ASPN meeting being held together. All right. And so we are now going to move to, not everybody of us in our community does research. Not everybody is transplanting, but everybody is doing chronic dialysis. So I think yep. that this was the session that most pediatric nephrologists were waiting for. So Emily, you have some introductory comments about it?
Yes. So within the dialysis session, there were four talks. The first one was on personalizing dialysis, then green dialysis, which I know we're all very interested in. The next one was bone health, and then heart health. So we have Neha here, who was a moderator. So do you want to start on the personalizing dialysis?
Yeah, for sure. So I was definitely really excited to be moderating this session. I'm a chronic dialysis director at Riley myself. Have been for 5 years. So I was getting to listen to four people who've been taking care of dialysis, and well, five, including Sarah Schwartz, you know, five people taking care of dialysis patients for a lot longer than me, and getting to like kind of learn from their experience. So Raj Munshi from Seattle Children's gave us the first talk regarding incremental dialysis and personalized dialysis regimens. And I thought it was interesting. Incremental dialysis, I've heard a lot from like adult side, adult chronic dialysis, and really incorporating that. But he really emphasized that in terms of like chronic peritoneal dialysis, we've been doing this in kids. This is very pediatrics, actually. So the idea of not focusing heavily on adequacy or KT over V, as much as what does that child actually need in terms of good nutrition and growth. And so when we start a child on PD, we don't start at 30 per kilo or the higher fill volume, right? We start lower and then we increase slowly. We may start at less number of cycles, less time, and then we slowly increase that too. We definitely know what our goal is and our goal KT over V is, but then we don't actually even stop there, right? We also think about after they're adequate, like what are their metabolic, you know, panel, what are their electrolytes doing, and how is their growth and nutrition ultimately, and base decisions off of that. And so he was really kind of challenging us to think about the same way with hemodialysis, which I think can be kind of shocking for people who've done chronic dialysis or take care of chronic dialysis patients for a long time. Like, let's, you know, instead of the three times a week in-center hemo for 4 hours, what if you started a patient on one or two times a week or less number of hours, because that's what they needed to in order to get good nutrition. And so I think it really challenges some of those beliefs we have about how should we treat with dialysis. But maybe there's something that's more personalized for each patient based off of their own needs.
So like N of one trials, essentially.
N of one trials. Yeah.
Although it becomes challenging, right? Because in a world where dialysis services are, you know, paid differently and, you know, based on metrics which dialysis centers have to meet, it is going to be a tough sell when we are dialyzing children in a dialysis center that primarily takes care of adults. That's one of the challenges many of us face. But also, if you're running your own pediatric dialysis unit, you have to meet some of those metrics. So that's what I was thinking as he was talking. I said, this is great. And we do it, right? We do this many mm-hmm. times, like especially children who have a lot of native output. We're still, we start slow and we kind of work our way up to what the patient needs. So I would argue we are doing a little bit of personalized medicine, but it was very nice to hear that organized and presented in such a systematic, thoughtful fashion.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like the CMS regulations for KT over V just like tie our hands a little bit. And, I think they're, thinking about a way to collectively describe our experience and research in some way with some of these patients where you don't start with that full prescription right away, hopefully can help change that, those kind of requirements for pediatric dialysis patients. But yeah, like it's not the same as for adult patients. And, that's honestly probably not what a lot of adult patients need either initially.
Yes. So it was very thoughtful.
Great. All right. What about green dialysis? I know before this, we were talking about the water. So much water goes into our hemodialysis patients.
Absolutely. Yeah. So Cynthia Wong from Stanford Children's gave this talk that everybody was quite excited to hear. And she really put the context of it as living in California and experiencing firsthand what drought is like. And, really the whole community, the state working hard to conserve water. And yet she's working in a unit where it wastes tons and tons of water. And so I think started to like really ask a lot of questions about why that is, what are ways in which we can conserve water or even reuse water that is like rejected by our water treatment systems. So I thought it was really thought-provoking, especially coming, I hadn't really thought much about this. But yeah, it goes to show that, depending where you live, you have to think about this more than I maybe have in the past. So yeah, I agree. I think what Emily, you and I had started talking about was especially like dialysis rate. So when I dialysis rate flows and in-center hemodialysis, uses so much water to make that dialysate. I was always trained as a fellow that the dialysis rate is this for every one of our patients, regardless of their size. This is just what we do. Same thing as I became faculty at Riley Children's. Cynthia talked about they did like a very simple, what sounded like very much QI, local QI work, where they looked at their dialysis rate, especially for their smaller patients, wrote it as 2 times the rate of the blood flow, and could use basically slower dialysis rates for smaller patients, higher ones for the larger patients, and save just water, liters and liters of water just that way. And so I thought it was probably something easily like applicable that centers could do, could adopt through QI methodology. Not something that requires a drastic change in a water treatment system, I guess.
Yeah.
Yes, awesome. I know. So Chuck, you have something to say about water, don't you?
I was just going to add that I try to take our residents or someone from our group does to like tour the dialysis unit, expose them to the outpatient side because they don't see it that much. I always specifically take them in the water room and I make them calculate how much water you use for a dialysis treatment and like walk them through the whole pathway. We actually even have a water Jeopardy PowerPoint that I made, which gets into like how the water's made and what the different alarms mean. So if anyone needs a water Jeopardy PowerPoint, send me an email. But I think that's one of the most fascinating parts. I don't even take care of a lot of dialysis patients, but I think the water room is so cool. So that's really neat that there's ways to think through this stuff.
I'll take your Jeopardy PowerPoint. That sounds so much fun.
Me too.
It's bad that my
absolutely
my favorite part is I always update the potent potables section every time I give it. So I have a lot of cocktail related trivia questions in there, but the rest of it's about dialysis.
That's wonderful. And Amy, you had drinks. Something to share.
Hold on, have you made drinks using the water?
Now that's advanced.
Okay.
You can use reverse osmosis, right, for that.
What would be a fun name for a drink made with dialysis effluent?
No, I don't think that's for us. I think maybe for the plants, right, Amy?
Yes, that's what I remember. This topic came up a few years ago in Neff Madness, and I thought that was so fascinating that it's actually just a fantastic fertilizer, the effluent, because it's just phosphorus rich and it's like a great way to, I guess, you know, people have been peeing on plants forever, but
use it for orchids or something, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I didn't think we could like sell it and market it and make money. Yeah.
Totally. Technology. Totally.
Yeah. Just plant an organic garden outside every dialysis unit and, you know.
Yeah. Community garden.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And like our PD patients who just have bags of it sitting around, they should sell it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, thanks to Cynthia, we all thought a lot about the amount of waste yeah. that goes on surrounding this life-saving therapy, right?
Yes, definitely.
Absolutely.
And then bone health, I know that is a very challenging topic. So anything new that we should know taking care of dialysis patients?
Yeah, anything new. I feel like every time I hear a talk on bone disease, especially from Justine Bachetta, who did for us there, I'm sitting there thinking, I still don't think I'm treating my patients exactly the way I should, you know, because there's just a lot of paradigm changes, you know, over years too. So Justine is just a great speaker, and she really highlighted a couple things that stuck with me, especially with our like infants on dialysis when it comes to secondary hyperpara and CKD-MBD. She talked a lot about total calcium intake and the calcium needs of infants, and are we really achieving what they need, or are we like just hitting below the mark, and how that can be definitely a driver for high PTH levels. And so identifying that from nutrition and formula, really focusing, like working with your dietitian to make sure they have enough calcium, even putting babies on calcium supplements if they're not making those needs. And then phosphorus as well. I think phosphorus, I feel, you know, avoiding hypophosphatemia is something we know. And then hyperphosphatemia too in infants, but she really focused on calcium. She interestingly brought up, and she laughed as she said this, in terms of different PTH goals between Europe and the United States, which also gave me some pause to know that she's practicing a little differently than KDIGO guidelines we have here. But I think trends are important, as what I tell like our fellows when we do our didactic lectures, is that really a PTH or calcium and phosphorus is you're watching trends and you're making adjustments related to that, rather than the single value on its own. So yeah, I thought she gave a great talk, and then had this cute little photo at the end of her presentation that everybody liked, of infants on dialysis sitting on a mat in the center of the dialysis unit and playing and interacting. And I was like, oh, I wish our dialysis unit looked like that too.
I know. Cool. I immediately thought, wow, you know, I've seen ECMO patients walking around and never thought of liberating our patients that way. But it was an excellent talk. And she is from our sister organization, ESPN, right? She mentioned that during her talk. Yep. That she's part of that organization. It's great to see all these international experts come and talk at ASPN annual conference.
Yeah, definitely. And then the last one on heart health, another very important topic in our dialysis patients.
Yeah, so Srivats gave a great talk. He's from Texas Children's Hospital. It was a very good review and summary of cardiovascular disease, especially in chronic hemodialysis patients, starting from kind of the beginning of like initial studies that looked at myocardial stunning and describing what that meant for patients on dialysis. I think he especially explained some things that even sometimes I don't know if I quite understood as well, like why our pediatric patients, we tend to see things like sudden cardiac death, arrhythmias, or strokes as are related to their cardiovascular disease versus MIs, like is traditionally seen. And adults, because those cardiovascular disease risk factors are just very different in children versus adults. So I'm glad he reviewed that again with us as a group, and then brought up some of the challenges of like interdialytic hypotension when patients have large fluid gains. You know, what do you do? You take off the fluid to dry weight, or do you limit, you know, how much fluid we're removing in a session, and what's the right target? Which are a lot of the questions that I think come up amongst people all over the country. I don't think that there are great like answers yet, but I think it just kind of challenges like the way we think about chronic dialysis and why, you know, there needs to be improvements in in-center hemo specifically.
Yeah, definitely. I know fluid has been a big topic recently, and yeah, we want to get our fluid off, but we have to make sure our patients are safe. So
yes.
All right. Well, this was a great session. Thank you all the moderators for being here and giving us the high yield points from PAS. Unfortunately, we couldn't have any of the critical care AKI folks come on to the podcast. They're all very popular people. And that was a really packed talk. I laugh because Dr. Sass from Mayo Clinic, when he asked his question, he said, "Gosh, I wish there was this many people at my Stone lectures." So it was a well-attended talk. So we started off with Kat Gist from Cincinnati, and she talked about WEROC, which, if you haven't read, it's the Worldwide Exploration of Renal Replacement Outcomes Collaborative in Kidney Disease. And so she kind of came up with a database and has put out a lot of manuscripts already so that we understand kind of the liberation patterns for CRRT and the long-term outcomes for our patients. So the big takeaway was that starting earlier really was associated with better outcomes. So make 90. So at 90 days, less likelihood of still being on dialysis and having CKD and then mortality as well. And then some other things that she mentioned was urine output at the time of CRRT start and 24 hours before liberation. So that those two things were predictive of whether or not a patient would be successful in liberating from CRRT. So I thought that was pretty cool. And then, of course, shorter duration on CRRT was predictive of being able to come off and liberate successfully.
Yes.
So that's what I took away from this whole thing. Just start earlier because the outcomes are better.
Absolutely right. I think that's again something that we work very closely with our the folks in the intensive care unit to try to come up with, you know, earlier referrals and when to, you know, call your friendly neighborhood nephrologist and things like that. So I think that was a great session and this particularly good talk.
Yeah. And then the next one was Dr. Goldstein, also from Cincinnati, who kind of walked us through almost a timeline of where the research has been in pediatric AKI.
This was the Adrian Spitzer lecture. Yes.
That's important. And so he talked about the AWARE study that was in 2017, where we realized that mortality is really high in kids who have AKI, who are in the ICU, and severe AKI is associated with death, increased length of stay, and ventilation, all bad things. So then he talked about the renal angina index, which is frustrating because patients don't have a symptom when they have AKI, but we, of course, know that there's a lot of risk factors for acute kidney injury. And so he explained his algorithm for doing the renal angina index along with the urinary NGAL and how that those two together can really increase the sensitivity and specificity of a severe AKI when you score patients when they get to the ICU. So I thought that was great. And then, of course, he again talked about how earlier CRRT is associated with less fluid overload, less PICU time, getting off the vent earlier, and using his tools, the renal angina index and the urinary NCAL, was able to improve outcomes. So patients were started on CRRT earlier, weren't on for as long, and just did better when they used that algorithm. So I thought that was excellent.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's great if that can be integrated into EMRs and show up as alerts or something so that it's system-wide available, right? So that's the next step. We need to get more folks onto this bandwagon and look at our patients more critically.
Right. Yeah, definitely. I know there are a few PICU attendings in the crowd, so hopefully they learn from this too and we can all be on the same page. The next one was a nutrition talk by Dr. Wong Vega from Texas Children's, and she talked a lot about protein. I know that that is kind of a tough topic sometimes in our patients who have renal failure in the ICU. We want to feed them, but we also don't love their BUN being too high. And so she did point out a study, I think it was in adult patients, though, that high protein actually wasn't necessarily beneficial, but we know that our patients are different. And so again, personalizing to them. And I know Dr. Goldstein asked, you know, he brought up a point that permissive uremia is actually may not be as harmful as we think. Yes. And then also enteral nutrition, doing that earlier can be helpful in calming down some inflammation.
Right. And, you know, just bringing the protein level, the protein that we are providing the patient, just bringing it down to even, you know, 0.7 to 1, I think, grams per keg is what she was saying.
Yeah.
Because otherwise they're giving like humongous amounts of protein. So for these patients, we are not advising restriction as such, but just don't overload them with protein at a time when their kidneys are trying to keep up.
Sure.
So that was what she clarified, I think, in the question answer session.
Right, because I think her point was patients can't even use a lot of the protein.
Exactly.
Right, they're too sick to use it. So
yes. Yeah. So I think that was very well taken, that point. And then we had one more talk to cover.
Yep, it was on ECMO, an AKI with Dr. Saluski from MUSC. And again, the theme was starting
early.
Earlier,
start early.
At a lower fluid overload percent, you know, below 10%. And I thought this is the first time I heard this. The patients who, you know, get put on CRRT with ECMO do better than the ones who just have the filter in line.
Yes.
So I think
he highlighted that in some of the work surrounding that.
Yeah, so I think that is a really great thing to bring back to your, you know, your center and try to help patients get them the dialysis that they need. And then again, fluid overload predicted mortality on ECMO. So
you
want to get the fluid off.
Yes. So he very humorously and engagingly brought home the point that, you know, if you are, you know, if your fluid overload percentage is high to begin with, how many days it takes to get you back to euvolemia, and how impossible that gets with every day you wait. So that is a great calculation to take back to our ICUs when they're a little reluctant to, you know, start using the dialysis machines and the circuits. So I thought that was really well done.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Anything else?
No, I think we covered a lot in this episode. I think this is the meat and bones of nephrology, the stuff that everyone likes. So I hope that our listeners will enjoy our quick and easy 1 hour recap. If you've missed, you know, the conference, or maybe you were out and about looking at the sites in Toronto and want to just get a earful of, you know, what went on and what are the new developments in our field of pediatric nephrology, I think that this episode is going to satisfy that need. So I want to sign off by saying thank you to my co-host, Emily, and for doing an excellent job filling in for Dr. Saluski, who unfortunately couldn't be here today.
I am not a replacement for Dr. Saluski at all. So hopefully I got across some good points, though. So
we will come back again with another episode of The Sediment for this year, 2024, when we will be talking about other great sessions that happened during ASPN annual meeting in Toronto this year.
Yeah.